Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 4th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon, we have Rinda West. Today's session is titled Reflections on Nature, Nature as Solace. Let's listen in.
This is a session called Nature as Solace, or Solace. I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce the word, but I think we can say it any way we want to. And I've been working all week with poetry about the human relationship to the natural world. To give you a little bit of insight into me and what you're going to get, I have a PhD in English, but my work was in modern drama at the time I did my dissertation. For the last 10 years, though, I've been team teaching with a biologist, and he teaches environmental science, and I teach literature about nature and the human relationship with nature. So that's been my experience for some time now. And I'm always in search of new books to teach, new poetry to teach, to explore a variety of issues about principally why the natural world is important to us and what it is that we gain when we are in contact with nature, when we're living harmoniously with nature, and what we lose when we're out of touch with nature. Most of us, I think, live in areas where our access to nature is nothing like what it is here at Holden Village. I live in Chicago, and I have to drive not as far as you might think. We have some nice natural areas in the Cook County area, but I still have to get in my car to get there. And that in itself does something to your relationship with nature. I live in a house which, as I'm sure you can imagine, has rectangular structures everywhere and looks quite a lot like some of the other houses on the street. And many of the objects in my house are mass-produced because I live in the United States, and that's the way we live, is with mass-produced stuff. So, and I feel like a lot of times there's an angry part of me. I don't know whether any of you have that. She often gets out when I'm in the car, and she gets pretty angry when people cut me off or try and pass me on the right and things like that. And I feel like it's easy in the city to feel alienated from other people, alienated from the natural world, even alienated from myself. And for me, what I've discovered is that I need to be in contact with the natural world, and a good connection with nature works on all three of those for me. It reconnects me with myself, it reconnects me with nature, it reconnects me with other human beings, and ultimately, of course, it reconnects me with God. And for me, that's what I get out of being in nature. I have four short poems for us to talk about today. All of them are like little commercials. Some people say that the commercial is the best developed art form in America today. But these are little commercials, and if you think about a commercial, it sets out a problem. Somebody's got bad breath. And it then gives us some sense of the horrible consequences that attend on this problem. The person isn't popular. It then presents the solution to the problem and shows the benefits of the solution that the solution offers to the sufferer. So all of these poems, in a sense, have contained within them an understanding of what it is that troubles the poet and what it is that heals the poet. And it's amazing how that can be done in a fairly short space of time. Let me say just two or three words about poetry. Lots of people are scared of poetry, and I think some of that comes out of high school English classes where the teachers sort of held a secret and that you were supposed to get the secret, and if you didn't get it, then there was something wrong with you. My approach to poetry is that poetry is a way of focusing meditation, and the meaning of the poem doesn't exist until you get into a relationship with it. So that the meaning of a poem is created by your reading of it in your relationship to the poem. And just like any other relationship, the meaning of the poem, the meaning of the relationship is a function of both people, not just of one and not just of the other. So sometimes when I say this sort of thing to classes of students, they'll say, oh, well, that's just my opinion and it's as good as anybody else's opinion. And yeah, sort of. But they can't really read a poem about nature and tell me that it's about Buicks. You know, there's a boundary, there's a community within which the conversation takes place. So I want to start with a lovely little poem by Wendell Berry called The Peace of Wild Things, which was a phrase that I worked into the description of the session. And if you want to just take one of those and pass it around. While it's going around, I'm going to just lay out for you three of the things that poets work with to create a poem. The first is imagery. And imagery refers to all the language in the poem that creates a sensory experience. So poets use visual images, and they use auditory images, and they use tactile images. Sometimes they'll use olfactory images, not quite so often. And sometimes there will even be kinesthetic images in it. But the image is the flesh of which the poem is the spirit, in a sense. The image is without the image, you don't know, you can't go beyond it. But we always go beyond the image. So the image is sort of the material world. The second thing that poets work with is relationships. And those are often expressed in poetry through similes and metaphor. And you'll come across both simile and metaphor in the poems that we're talking about. And just to review your high school English, a simile is a comparison between two things that uses like or as. So that I might say to Carolyn, your hair is like the flowers. And you know, that way we can say, well, okay, she's blonde, flowers are yellow, flowers are beautiful, her hair is beautiful. But it doesn't say her hair is a flower. A metaphor is a comparison that equates two things that are usually unlike. And what poets do with that, with both simile and metaphor, is to change our point of view by showing us connections that we might not otherwise have seen. And often when you see something connected to something that you unexpected, it gives you an insight that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. And the third thing that poets work with, of course, is language. And we'll talk a little bit about how that takes place in terms of things like rhyme, sound, and so on. So I'm going to just read this poem, and I'm going to read it out loud once, and then, excuse me, I'll give you a minute or two to read it through to yourself again, because a poem doesn't yield itself instantly. It takes a little while with it. So Berry calls this The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. So take a minute to just read it through again yourself. So are there images or lines that speak to you immediately?
Day-blind stars.
Exactly.
Fabulous. It's an interesting image, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you talk about it a little bit? How, what do you associate with it?
Well, you never associate stars with day. And the stars are there and are blind to the day, waiting with their light. I'm not sure about that. But the, I don't know what more to say.
Okay, great.
Same question. Day blind stars. Is this, is the day blind to the stars, or the stars blind to the day? Who's waiting? Are they waiting for their light to shine? Am I waiting for their light to shine? Is the day waiting for their light to shine?
Yes, that's wonderful. That's wonderful, because what the poem does is to say that both of those, all of those interpretations, all of those readings are there. So perhaps the stars are blind. Perhaps we are blind to the stars.
Well, the stars are shining, whether we see it or not.
That's right. That's right.
They have to shine all the time. It's part of the cosmos.
Yes. But we are, by day, blind to the stars, are we not? Does that image go anywhere for you? To me, it's kind of a solace to think that the stars are always there, whether I can see them or not. That the light is always there, even if I'm not looking at it, even if I'm in the house, even if it's nighttime.
We were coming over the pass and we saw in all its glory with no cloud, cloudy pass, we saw Glacier Peak in all its glory.
Mm.
Whereas other times, you could be in an area for a week and never see it, then you could swear it wasn't there.
Mm.
But you, if you know it's there, there's a feeling, it's always there.
And then when it reveals itself to you, what a wonderful moment. Yeah.
Like a ship that comes through the fog. You might sense that it's there, but you can't see it until it moves into your vision.
Yeah. What else in the poem did you find interesting or spoke to you?
When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be.
Those are strong lines, aren't they? Hi. We're working on the first poem, so.
Sorry.
That's okay. It's okay. What's your response to those lines?
Well, it's one of those times for me when the poem says, it gives language to an experience that I have. And it's my first response, whenever that happens to me, is a sense of relief that someone else has had those feelings and can name them. It sort of gives me space to take another breath.
I think it's interesting, some of the little words in there, despair for the world, is the problem that he identifies. It's not despair at the world. It's not, in a sense, I mean, he's not saying that the problem is in him so much as he's saying that the problem is in the world. And in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be. Any thoughts about that one?
Certainly as parents, that's one of the things we lay awake and fret about at night, is our children's lives.
Yes. He's concerned for the future here, isn't he? And so he picks that up later, a few lines down, where he talks about the wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. That what we do is to tax ourselves with what may happen, with our worries, our anxieties. I don't know about you, but I have a gerbil that has a wheel, and it's in my head and runs around on that wheel all the time, and there are four or five little things that it stops at and says, and then it goes on a little more. So there's that sense that so much of what we live with in terms of anxiety is forethought of grief that may or may not come to pass. And there's some grief that we know will come to pass ultimately, but...
In contrast to I hear the experience of watching quietly the great blue heron
yes.
for a fish to come within range. And the calmness, the patience, the stillness, the calm of all that.
Yes, right.
Compared to what we get involved in.
Right. And if you look at what the animals that he describes are doing, the wood drake is simply resting in his beauty on the water. And I think that's just lovely. The wood drake does not have to be out earning money or winning prizes or gaining fame. The wood drake rests in his beauty. And the great heron feeds. And yes, it gives you that whole image of the patience of the heron sitting and waiting there. So he uses, and he also talks about still water. I come into the presence of still water. So he takes a specifically lakeside kind of image as the one that he goes to for solace here. There's the drake on the water. There's the heron waiting patiently. There's the still water. And then above it all, the knowledge of the stars. The knowledge of the day-blind stars. So we've got this very quiet scene that he presents for us. And he talks about the peace of wild things, which is not a word that you might necessarily associate with wild things. I think most of us, when we think of the word wild, have other associations that we bring to that. But the other word he uses in the last line, for a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. Now, how do you understand the grace that he's talking about here?
The natural way that the animals, birds, flowers, and so forth, they just do things. That they're doing, and it's a natural way. So it is a grace. It is a gift.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to add to that?
The word grace has different meanings, and one of them is the gift, and another is in the sense of graceful,
mm-hmm.
of things being lovely and just the way they should be.
Mm-hmm. Right, and both of those work here, don't
right.
they? Anyone else have any thoughts on the grace of wild things?
I think of balance.
Of balance, yeah.
Balance. Mm-hmm. Wild things, it may be survival, but it's all within a whole balance.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yes. And you think of a dancer being graceful, that's balance, isn't it? The equilibrium. And it's a grace that the wild things have, at least in this poem, that we don't have because of foreknowledge, forethought of grief. So let's hold that forethought of grief in our minds as one of the occasions from which causes us to seek solace in nature. The next one is a little prayer by a rabbi. All of these poems, or almost all of them, are drawn from this book, Earth Prayers, which is a nice anthology of short and not terribly difficult. Difficult in the way that some poems are, because you can't be clear about what the word order is on poems. Grant me the ability to be alone. May it be my custom to go outdoors each day among the trees and grasses, among all growing things, and there may I be alone, and enter into prayer to talk with the one that I belong to. What do you find in this one that you respond to? Or?
It's in the solitude.
Is solitude hard?
Can be.
It can be, yeah.
The difference between being alone and being alone. Alone may be a renewing experience.
Yes. And yet it's hard for some people to do that. Now evidently it's hard for the poet to do that, because that's what the prayer is, isn't it? The prayer is to have the ability to be alone. Do you think that solitude in nature helps you to absorb the solace that's there?
Yes.
Does for you?
It does.
Mm-hmm.
There's interference. Noise would be an interference. Even talk or so could be an interference.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't pick up everything. The quietness allows you to see.
Yes, the quietness allows you to see. I like that. That's very nice. Yeah. What about other people?
Closer to God.
You feel closer to God when you're alone?
Up here a little bit. Beautiful mountains. I know it's God's creek. Yeah.
It is, isn't it?
I think thinking about the word ability.
Mm-hmm.
Infers for me that almost that I need to know, learn how to do it. It's not so hard here to find solace or quietude or whatever, but when you're at home or in the busyness of your life, it is hard to find it, I think, and I think one needs to have the ability or the language or the understanding or whatever it takes, someone, a way in which to calm yourself down, say, I can do this,
mm-hmm.
or how, the ability is how to know not only that you, it's helpful and that you need it and to take the time to do it, but then to know how to do it when you seek that's what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there really are two things going on here. One is, whatever it is that you need to, whatever that ability is to be alone, is not always in everyone. For some people it's natural, for other people it isn't natural, and they have to learn that to be alone is not to be lonely. That to be alone can be meditative, can be enough. But then the other part of it is the mindfulness to remember that we need it. When your, you know, phone is ringing and you have meetings and there's places to go and stimulation everywhere. Were you going to add something?
No.
Oh.
The poet seeks and finds that highest aloneness, apparently, among the trees and grasses, among the growing things.
Yes, right.
I was feeling pretty pensive. We just came back from this walk of the old miners' village.
Mm-hmm.
At one time there were 125 houses. Now, nature has reclaimed herself, and there's very little evidence left. But we were walking, standing within the echoes of the families and the community that mm-hmm. was here once, way up where there's nothing now, much now. Thinking of the growing things, it kind of brings things back to nature being alone, you know. And if you can be there and feel comfortable, it's a wonderful thing.
It is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing to see nature take something over that's been interfered with. I mean, even to see a flower grow up in your sidewalk can be a wonderful thing.
It can also be an issue of safety. This imagery, we don't know what has gotten his way of the ability to be alone, but it may be the things that he's trying to get among are very benign and very safe and very relaxing. And would feel safe in his prayer and not threatened from hostile things.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But this wilderness also brings up another point. Nature is not only the place where we live, it's also the place where we die. So there is a certain fear involved in, I think, in being here, and especially also being alone in nature. You could get very afraid of nature when you see waterfalls or other great nature things, you know, which are overwhelming in many respects. And eventually, nature will be the place where mankind will be buried, you know. So there's a certain fear also involved.
I think that's very important. I think it's important to remember that nature is not always safe, and that there is this awesome power in nature. As you say, we confront it by waterfalls. If you go on any of the hikes where there's a bridge across a waterfall, often when they don't have handles on them and you just stand there, I find myself getting into fantasies of just the water coming powerfully, rushing down and sweeping me away. And there's a part of me that likes the idea of the cleansing, you know, the sort of perpetual cleansing of that water falling. And part of me that is flirting with the dangerous power of that water. And you know, you see that in the awesome austerity of the mountains as well.
There's also the stars you mentioned before. They can fall on us, you know, and that would be a big headache.
Well, it was for the dinosaurs, from what we understand.
Right. It was a big headache for them.
Yeah, yeah. So here we have, I mean, I, as far as I'm concerned, you can go outdoors every day in the city. And if outdoors offers you solace, if the sense, as it does for me, of being in something that is not constructed, not man-made, gives you the feeling of being in direct contact with God, direct communion with God. Even in my backyard, there's grass growing, there's a tree growing, there's flowers growing. I can sit and be there and touch the earth if I make up my mind to do it. And sometimes we have to pray for the intention to do that. Okay, I have two more that are both lovely poems. And again, I'll ask you to be the poem starter here. So we've had two poems that offer different problems as the provocation to the retreat to nature. The first was Forethought of Grief, or Despair for the World, and the second was Implied, a kind of inability to be alone, a kind of busyness, a kind of need for distraction. Do we have enough? Great. The third is a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins, whom some of you may know. Hopkins was a Jesuit, a British Jesuit, in the 19th century. I think he died in 1881, but his poems weren't published until this century, because he considered them too self-indulgent, I think, for a person of his vows. This one is called Pied Beauty, and it's one of his most famous. And you may notice that the rhythm of the line doesn't sound like the rhythm of most lines of poetry that you'll read in English. So that'll be something to compare with the next one, but let me read this to you. Pied Beauty. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal chestnut falls, finches' wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, and all trades, their gear and tackle and trim. All things counter, original, spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle, dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. Now, if you get lost in this, the thing to remember is everything that follows the first line, except for the last part, is a list of all the things that he's including in the category dappled things. So dappled things then are things that are not pure or single, but are mixed, complicated, many colored. So take a look through it again and just let yourself be swallowed by his images. Anybody have any words or lines that you need to get cleared up because they don't make any sense or you don't know what they mean?
Oh, it's brinded cow.
Well, I think that a brinded cow is a cow that's got more than, that's got sort of spots on it.
Isn't the word brindled?
Well, the word is brindled, but he uses brinded. So he made his own word up, in a sense, which he does a lot. He makes up his own words. So yes, a multicolored cow.
And is couple color, for, is that like two?
Mm-hmm.
Just two colors. Couple colors, like blue and white. What about all trades, their gear and tackle and trim? How is that brindled or dappled?
Well, he goes and changes his terms just a little bit down there where he gets to landscape plotted and pieced and all trades. So that line, all trades, really goes into the next stanza, all things counter, original, spare, strange. And I think what you get in the poem is a sense of praise for everything that is uniquely itself, that is most assertively there just as itself. It's very much a poem that is celebrating the world, the physical world.
But a varied collection.
And a very varied collection, yes. So that he's not praising things that have achieved perfection, things that are idealized or things that are mass-produced, but rather things that are idiosyncratic, that are particular, that are unique. I once had a friend who said to me that one of the great blessings to her of being in a forest is that there's no right way to be a tree in the forest. And we live in a culture that sets up models for us. For women, there's this sort of oppressive image of female beauty that you're supposed to admire and emulate, as though beautiful people all looked alike, you know. And for men, there's the image of the successful man driving the right car. And what Hopkins does is to invert all of that and to value instead the one who looks like himself. the one who is her own self, that is unique, that is individual.
I came down the hill one day at Holden Village a number of years ago when we'd had two fire alarms during the night, and I was on the microphone in the morning, and whoever signed up to do matins forgot or didn't come or something, so I had to do matins. And I read this poem, "Glory be to God for dappled things," and gave thanks for dappled nights. You know, we got to see the moon in the middle of the night, and we got to think our night thoughts in the night, and, you know, giving thanks for the unusualness of that night.
That's nice.
Probably
yes.
Not everyone shared that sentiment.
Well, he goes also from naming things mm-hmm. to describing things.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's talking about skies and cows and moles and chestnut finches' wings, then he talks about original, spare, strange, fickle. Those are not things. Those are just descriptive
mm-hmm.
words.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know about the last line.
Praising?
No, the second last line, sorry. He fathers forth whose beauty is past change. I don't understand that.
Okay, it goes back to glory be to God for dappled things. So, these are all things that God has fathered, or fathered forth, if you need an extra syllable.
Okay.
And God's beauty is past change. He whose beauty is past change, he fathers forth. Yeah, the grammar is often very tricky in Hopkins' poems. Phrases like fresh fire coal chestnut falls. Mm-hmm. You know, you think to yourself, is that two images or four images? Or one image.
Is he also playing with sounds at that point?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, he likes the sounds of the words. He likes the rhythm of the line. Mm-hmm. So that where, and just to read the first line of the Yeats poem that's going to follow this, "I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree." You see, there are regular beats in there. "I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree." So you've got this regular metrical beat in the Yeats poem, which is what we come to expect in English. The standard line of verse in English is in what's called iambic pentameter. I don't know if people are familiar with that, but it's a line of 10 syllables with 5 beats in the line. So if you think of any line from Shakespeare, it's probably written in iambic pentameter. "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date." So that's what we expect, and that, people say, I don't know who these people are, is the most natural pattern of speech in English. That the pattern of speech in English is an unaccented followed by an accented syllable. So we're all poets. But Hopkins created what he called himself sprung rhythm. And it's a rhythm that is directed by the images, and often it's sprung because he's compressed so much in the line. You know, that you think about a spring getting coiled up tightly. So he sets us up with a line that sounds like it's going to be a little bit regular. "Glory be to God for dappled things." Oh no. And then he comes in with landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, so that it gets very dense. There's not lots of little sort of unaccented syllables in there that we usually expect for catching our breath and things. "And all trades, their gear and tackle and trim," at least we get the ends. "All things counter, original, spare, strange." So we get this very compressed rhythm. So that what happens in the poem is that the language of the poem itself is one of the things that he praises. Because the language of the poem itself is dappled, is spare, original, and strange. And the poem then sort of acts out the idea that he's expressing by making itself so intense.
The line that comes home to my feeling the most is the one, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how.
Yes, isn't that lovely? Fickle and freckled, of course, share the sound, and so they work nicely for him, and he's very fond of that kind of stuff. But fickle and freckled have fairly different meanings, don't they? Fickle we associate with, I don't know, you associate it with a young person who's in love with first this one and then that one and then the other one and never settling on one.
Totally prescribed situation.
Yes.
It's the unusual or unexpected.
Yes.
Appreciating all that.
Right. Appreciating the unexpected, yes. Appreciating whimsy. And then freckled is much more literal, but the parenthesis in there is another one of his little poet's tricks, because what he's done is to freckle the line, to decorate the line with the little little aside. And then the next line, if you look at the punctuation in it, it's wonderful. Whatever is freckled with opposites. With swift, it's freckled with slow. With sweet, it's freckled with sour. With a dazzle, it's freckled with dim. And you can just picture the man sitting there trying, coming up with these specific words. And it's easy 100 years after the poem was written to look at it and think, oh, this is nice. But imagine writing this. Imagine searching for the right words there. And what's surprising is that the poem actually has rhymes. When you read it, they're so subtle that you almost don't pay attention to that. But you've got things, cow, swim, wings, plow, trim. Strange, how, dim, change, him. So the poem has the container of the rhymes, but within the container it has this very intense, I mean, it's sort of like going into somebody's toolbox, and the toolbox has screws and bolts and chocolate chips and pieces of gum and crayons and needles and thread and, you know, sort of like everything compressed there in the toolbox.
Did he write, when you read through a lot of Hopkins, do you find similar construction in the poetry?
Yes. Yes, this is very characteristic. He wrote a lot of sonnets. And the sonnet form, as you probably know, is 14 lines, which is usually composed with either 4, 4, 4, and 2, or 8 and 6. And it's like playing a game. To write a sonnet is to undertake to play a game that's got boundaries, and it's got rules, and it's got conventions and expectations. You know, when you write a sonnet, you're playing basketball, and you have there's sidelines, there's goals and stuff. Unlike writing something like the Wendell Berry poem, which is an organic form. And so to write sonnets and mess with them is one of the things that poets like to do. You're taking on something that everybody else has done, and you're seeing how you can make it your own.
And still have to be a sonnet.
And still have it be a sonnet, right, so that anyone who comes and takes a look at it would say, oh yes, that's a sonnet. Mm-hmm. I have some sonnets next week. I don't have any sonnets today, I'm afraid. So we have enough time, I think, to look at the Lake Isle of Innisfree. William Butler Yeats, I think his dates are something like 1865 to 1939. I know the 1939, I'm not sure of the 1865, but that feels right to me. He was an Irish poet, and actively involved in the Irish cultural renaissance, and very engaged with, but never entirely embracing, the Irish struggle for freedom from the British. This is an early poem. Innisfree was a place in the country, in the Irish countryside, near where Yeats grew up, and he spent some time as a young man in London. So this poem is a recollection of Ireland when he's in this foreign and oppressive city. I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings, and midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core. Sorry about the typo there, it should be pavement's gray and not pavement's blue. Which images in this or which lines in this do you respond to?
What are wattles?
To make something out of clay and wattles is to take sticks and clay and put the sticks in, stick them together with the clay. So it's a kind of plaster.
Sort of liked where he wrote, "For peace comes dropping slow."
Mm-hmm.
Sort of ties into the earlier poems about nature being restful and just really finding that sort of peace and calming down.
It's interesting that peace is the word that recurs, isn't it? What people find in nature is peace.
Dropping
slow, right. What do you...
Well, this uses imaging of his workshop on stress, where to help people relax your whole body, arm your muscles, and then think of some place.
Mm-hmm.
He's thinking of Innisfree.
Yes, right.
Where you can go mentally and be there.
Exactly.
Even though you don't move from the place, you still are thinking
right.
of that place, and that's what he's doing here.
Right.
He's just putting himself
mm-hmm.
into a different place that was, to him, is a place of beauty and peace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that image of peace comes dropping slow. It's sort of evocative of some kind of water falling, because that's what we think of as dropping, but also, as you get into a peaceful place, you slowly lose some of the stress of your everyday life, and the peace kind of drops into you, slowly, not fast.
Well, it's like the peace of God's shalom, the, you know, maybe all you need.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the same way that each ill would be covered.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right, that as with a veil, in a sense. And comes and embraces you, yeah. Yeah.
It's nice that each of us can have such a place. I know a place high in the mountains called Rock Lake, and a waterfall comes down, and a permanent snowfield comes down.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you can think of a place like that, like to him, that's Innisfree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can go mentally and be reinfectious mm-hmm. without even physically necessarily making it possible to be there.
Okay, I think that's what the poem is offering us as its grace, as its gift, is it's offering us, well before there were stress relief seminars, there was this poem, there was I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, and it's an ancient idea that we can contain a place within us, a place where we feel peaceful. And for me, Holden does that in powerful ways. Well, I was last here in 1987, and there are places here that I have in my heart that give me comfort, and that I can call up and call to mind in very vivid ways. I mean, almost feel the breeze of the waterfall and the kind of dappled sunlight as you go through those cathedral pines. And if you can find such a place for you, who knows what it'll be? Spend some time there. Absorb it. The flies are such a vexation because it's hard to spend time in the places where you want to be able to be quiet and be alone or, you know, just be. But I think it's worth bearing with the flies to try to absorb those places and then make them a part of your being. Hold them in. Hold them in as he's got in his free in here. And for him, for poets, the poem itself becomes a kind of access to that place. So how do you get to your place? You need a way to get there. And a poem can do it, a prayer can do it. Something that you can say to yourself that helps to still the words, those forethoughts of grief, all of that gerbling that we do in our day-to-day lives, that for me, poetry is a wonderful container that holds experiences. And then if I can come back to a poem, the poem has a way of transporting me from one place to another.
In fact, in this poem, I think all of my adult life, the line, nine bean rows, will I grow there, evokes the whole poem for me and the place, and the picture of the place. There's something about that line that I love. I think it's, you can almost smell the soil, you tilled it, you have this nine, it's so plain, it's so sort of common nine bean rows.
The nine is wonderful in there, isn't it?
Yeah.
The precision of that, the kind of love of the attention to the detail of nine bean rows. And that's one of the things I love about this poem is that it's the images are so precise, they're so loving, that he's got this place pictured so clearly. And I like the bee loud glade.
Yeah, I live alone in the bee loud glade. And it's nice because the nine bean rows will I have there is the gets you into the beans. And then the hive for the honeybee. And then the next line brings the honeybees and the beans together just in sound. Because you've got your bees and your beans and the bee loud glade.
And you can almost feel heat as you hear the noise of the honeybees. So that nature isn't silent, certainly, but it's peaceful.
And then I like the last line, too. I hear it in the deep heart's core. I'm not sure why I like that. I don't usually like vague lines like that, but somehow the poem brings it home and makes that line.
In the second stanza, the second line, he could have said, oh, and peace from dawn till dusk. That wouldn't do it.
Right.
Dripping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings.
Veils of the morning is an interesting use of language, too, because you can picture a kind of early morning fog or mist, and that is something from which there can be drops, too, drops of water, but he doesn't say the mists of the morning. It's the veils of the morning, so that you get the figure of speech there.
So while I stand on the roadway or on the pavements, gray sort of helps us with the idea that you can be in the middle of the city or something and invoke this place.
Exactly, and he puts it, the city is there only in that penultimate line. You know, there's not a lot here of forethought of grief or the, you know, the sort of the presenting problem, and it's not till the end of the poem that you understand what the place means to him and how it works for him.
And the rest rises out of his deep heart's core.
And everything rises out of his deep heart's core. And what he, how he keeps it is the sound, too. For always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. And of course the line imitates the sound of water lapping on the shore with the alliteration of the L's there.
Like you say, if you have a place in your mind that's real, you've been there.
That's right.
Then you can close your eyes and you can feel the breeze, you can feel everything.
Mm-hmm.
You hear the sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Copper Basin.
Copper Basin?
Yeah.
Is that it for you?
Well, that's one of them.
I used to have a postcard, of all things, that I had got in the Ho Rainforest, in the Ho Valley in the Olympic Peninsula. This little, you know, a little itty-bitty postcard like this, and I had it sitting by my desk at work. And there were times when I just would stare at it and almost be on that trail.
And be there.
And be there, yeah.
Usually be all wet.
Exactly. Which was kind of nice in my office.
Yeah.
Well, we need to close. Thank you all very much for coming and sharing your thoughts and responses to the poems. I always feel like I walk away from a workshop like this much richer than I came to it because of everybody's associations. So thank you.
Thank you.